Can our expectations about inflation lead to higher inflation? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Monday, May 17th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, macroeconomist Joe Santos returns to help us unpack the consumer price index. From the price of gas to the price of a used vehicle, we look at the ongoing quirks of a pandemic economy. Richard Two Bulls has the story of a man who hiked 70 miles to join the Marines in order to help his family, his community, and his country. Brian Gevick brings the sounds of electric guitars as our Images of the Past feature explores old guitars and the local musicians who love them. Plus, Nate Wack recaps the thrilling journey, devastating loss, and undampened spirit for the SDSU Jacks. That's later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary. South Dakota State University fell short in the football championship subdivision national championship. The Jackrabbits lost Sunday to Sam Houston. The Bearcats scored the go-ahead touchdown with 16 seconds left and won 23-21. It was the first national title game appearance for longtime Jackrabbits head coach John Stiglmeyer.
I'm very proud of our program. I have been for decades. More proud today than ever. We had a chance to be national champs and we fell short. We didn't come to Frisco, Texas to do that. And so our guys are resilient. They're winners. They're unbelievable student athletes. And I expect them to roll up their sleeves and go back to work and do everything they can to get back to Frisco.
Heavy rain and strong winds played a significant role in the game. SDSU quarterback Mark Gronowski suffered an apparent knee injury during the team's first offensive possession. He didn't return to action. The football season was postponed from the fall to the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Jacks will take a few weeks off before beginning preparations for a normal schedule this fall. They'll open the season September 4th at Colorado State. A legislative committee is approving a rule that prevents law enforcement officers from using medical marijuana. That rule conflicts with a voter-approved medical marijuana program. The program prevents disciplinary action against licensed professionals for using medical cannabis. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
The Law Enforcement Officers Standard and Training Commission is changing the definition of moral conduct by officers and 911 dispatchers. That includes preventing marijuana use, which was approved by voters in November. Paul Bashand is with the commission. He says if law enforcement officers are involved in a shooting while on duty, they're given a urinalysis test after the fact. If officers have marijuana in their system,
that creates a whole host of problems related to not only that shooting, but similarly his certification. When you look at the federal law, marijuana is a controlled substance under the Federal Controlled Substances Act and says you cannot possess a firearm.
Bashan said he did not look at what nearby states are doing about cop licensure and medical marijuana policy. He says the Law Enforcement Licensing Board is comfortable with the language and the new rules. The Colorado Peace Officer Standards and Training Board does not have a similar rule. Their employers have the legal right to ban off-duty use of certain substances by their employees. South Dakota Democratic Representative Ryan Schwach voted against the licensure rule. He says it should not include 911 dispatchers.
It's hard for me to see how if a doctor prescribed them medication for their anxiety that may come from having a difficult job, if the doctor felt that medical marijuana off hours was the best for that dispatcher, I don't understand why we're prohibiting that.
The new rule conflicts with a provision in the voter-approved medical marijuana program. That provision protects licensed professionals from losing their certification if they have a medical marijuana prescription. Governor Kristi Noem wanted to delay implementation of the program for a year so lawmakers could study any conflict in state law. Legislators declined to go along. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
It'll be mostly cloudy and warm with isolated thunderstorms expected in the southeast today, mostly sunny in the west. With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The CDC says if you're vaccinated and have reached that point of immunity, you can take off your mask. But with 51% of South Dakotans having received their first vaccine dose only, what happens to the unvaccinated? Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, and he joins us now with our COVID-19 update. Dr. Kura, welcome.
Thank you, Lori.
All right. We're pretty excited about getting rid of some of those social distance requirements and those masks. But my question is, 51% South Dakotans and 51% have received the full series. 56 have received their first dose, to be clear. Is that enough? Because we're not at that 70% mark for sure.
Yes, and the question is a good one, and I'll add one more statistic to that, which is important here. Those over the age of 65 in the state of South Dakota, that percentage is with at least one dose is 90%. So that's one good bright statistic in the other two that you mentioned. The concern is if it's just about 50 or 56%, maybe we are in that gray zone. Ideally, if you told me today that we're at 65%, I would take more heart because there is some natural immunity from those that are infected. But there's an overlap there. Some folks that are infected also opted to get the vaccine, and we don't know what percentage of those people got the vaccine.
Our rate of vaccination has dropped substantially. What are you seeing for how many people are showing up to get vaccinated at this point?
You're very correct. The rate has dropped substantially, at least by 25 to 30%. What it also means is this is a slower, if you will, line to get the vaccine. So think of it this way. I think there was a rush to get the vaccine by folks that were really at risk, and this is why we prioritized, given the supply chain being slow. So that's one way of looking at it. Maybe it's slow because the risks are lower, and folks, being, thoughtful about it, are saying, "Well, I'll get mine in time. I'll let other folks get in." And some people are just waiting rather than hesitating. Almost like I'm not sure which one it is. I'm hopeful if we continue to get the message out there to folks to say, we need those of you who are waiting, I wouldn't call them hesitating, just go on and get it, because the risks of getting the disease, even though they are low in terms of hospitalization, the unknowns are what does it do long-term to the health of your lungs, your heart, your brain, and we are not entirely sure that risk there is low.
What about children who are not eligible for the vaccine if they're younger kids? You and I talked before about the adults really building a firewall around those kids who couldn't get the vaccine. Any more thoughts on kids who can't get vaccinated kind of going back into a society where all the adults are unmasked?
Absolutely. And then that is a very good point, Lori. I think we are at that stage already where people are free to unmask on our system. It would be really sad if we did not get our vaccination rates up to 70% at least. And that would be the best way we can to protect the vulnerable. And we're talking now of the pediatric groups below the age of 12. And these folks between ages 12 and below are at high risk for what's called multi-system inflammatory syndrome, a special condition that is still rare, but once it affects one of these children, it's devastating. It destroys pretty much every single organ. That's why it's called multi-system. Worse still, even though it's minor, if it was my child or a child I knew, I would really be crying tears. So I think it is a very big point you raise. We as adults should go get the vaccine. And this is the best way we can to help our kids who are going to be totally exposed.
So if you are a family and you have a child who's 7 or 8 or 12 and under, everyone else in your family has been vaccinated, what kinds of precautions do you need to take as a family to protect that last those few unvaccinated kids when you go to a restaurant, when you go to church, when you stay at home? What precautions do you still recommend for the unvaccinated children who can't get the vaccine.
Yeah, and this will simply be a difficult one, given that we are following an honor system now with the CDC recommending those vaccinated not to have to wear masks. It's hard to know if other folks are unwittingly, and maybe not necessarily with in a willful way, but just being casual about it and not understanding the risks, exposing the children. So it's very difficult to say, other than to wash your hands and, you know, try to avoid folks with symptoms. And hopefully people going to these gatherings in churches and bars and restaurants are being conscientious and staying home if they're ill and if they're not vaccinated.
All right. Any final thoughts on what we need to do going forward with our COVID precautions in a society that really wants to get back to normal?
I think it's great that the CDC came because the evidence is strongly favoring anyone vaccinated is at low risk for transmission. What I'd like to see is more folks stepping up and getting the shots. It's our best way to save our society, our children, our other vulnerable people that people don't talk about, because there are folks that have immune-compromised conditions like cancer, rheumatological diseases, autoimmune diseases, that cannot be adequately protected even with the vaccine. So very important, if we care about our community, we need to do that.
Dr. Shankar Kura with Monument Health. He's Vice President of Medical Affairs. Thank you very much for the update this week, Dr. Kura. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
After the break, Richard Tubles is with us. We'll talk about a veteran with an extraordinary story of just getting to the recruiting office. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
The world's attention has been on India lately, but the coronavirus is also raging in South America. Current death rates per capita in Argentina and Peru are among the highest in the world.
Health officials relaxed a little, expecting there not to be a second wave because the first wave had been so bad.
South America and the pandemic, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly with Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
Imagine a South Dakotan who cares about current
events. Steven says, go ahead, Joe, if you could just give me
their time and money to help make their community a better place to live. You've just imagined a listener of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. If your company needs to reach well-educated, loyal customers, please consider becoming an underwriter. SDPB is trusted and clutter-free. Your company message doesn't have to be loud or long to get attention here. Our listeners will notice you. Email us, underwrite@sdpb.org.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota First? FirstDakota.com/first.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. An Oglala Lakota instructor and mentor is celebrating 30 years of educating on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. But before that, Bill Tenfinger spent many years in the Marine Corps in the avionics field, making sure that aircraft were ready for their next mission. SDPB's Richard Tubles joins us today. Richard, I understand Tenfingers is your uncle. Tell me a little bit about this relative and this really fascinating life that he has led so far.
Hey, Lori, nice to talk to you again. So, yeah, my Uncle Bill grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and what makes his household child, you know, what makes his childhood unique is that he is one of 15 siblings that grew up in a small household in a very rural setting along the White River.
Wow. So he has a love for the sky early on. Tell me more about that.
You know, my Uncle Bill said that, you know, even his mom told him that he was always fascinated with airplanes as a child. And he said he remembered all the different kinds of aircraft, Lori, that existed throughout the years. I think growing up, we all had something that we were really, really into as kids. And Anyways, I think it's very fascinating. You know, he and another young Lakota man had gotten sponsored to take flying lessons in Valentine, Nebraska.
And I remember on the 13th hour, I took the plane up itself and landed it by myself. I was only 16. I know, that's pretty cool. I look back, a Cessna 150, and I thought, you know, I thought it was a lot of fun. And the other plane we used was a Piper Cub. But I was 16 years old, flying a plane by myself and landing. That was pretty fun. Got to live a dream flying an airplane.
Wow. 16 years old, landing it by himself. So Richard, that transitions into him joining the Marines, of all things.
Well, you know, Lori, much like myself today, you know, I have two young children, and my Uncle Bill at the time, he just started his family, and he felt that in order to take care of them, since jobs can be somewhat scarce on the reservation, he decided to enlist, and this was around 1980.
I got up one morning and told the wife, I said, yo, Mom, I got to take care of you guys. I said, there's no jobs here in the res. So I said, I'm going to join the Marines today. She just laughs. I hitchhiked to Moguala. Back then, they had the recruiting station down by Prairie Bottle, Times Square. So I went in there, took the ASVAB, took the oath office, and hitchhiked back and told her, I said, join the Marines.
Richard, how far is that? He hitchhiked how far just to enlist?
Well, I think it's like 70 miles to Rapid City. And then, you know, also, Lori, he still had to hitchhike back. So that's well over 100 miles. And what's fascinating about that is I think that's kind of something that could be a prerequisite to join the Marine Corps. I mean, I think you would know more than me in that aspect, but I think that might have been his first test.
Yeah, you know, when I joined the Marines, I went down to the recruiters, Richard, and they used to be in Sioux Falls. They used to be all, you know, one after another, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. I had no interest in joining the Air Force. The Navy was not taking any women. All their female billets for women were full. And I walked in front of the Army recruiters, and there was this recruiter with this Corvette convertible, and he looked me up and down and he winked at me, and I was like, nope, not the Army. So I went into the Marine Corps recruiting station, said, what you got? And that's where the journey began. How did you end up in the Navy? You're in the Navy, right?
I got out of I graduated high school, and I worked on my grandfather's ranch, and you know, my grandfather and my father and my sister, well, my sister was in at the time, but my grandfather and my dad were veterans of the Navy. And I decided I wanted to join the military. And I said, I think I'm going to join the Navy. And within that same hour, I thought about that. A recruiter called from the Navy. So I just went with it.
Wow. I did not have to hitchhike, nor did I ever have to hike 70 miles in the Marines. So your Uncle Richard, or your uncle, is a way above and beyond anything that I ever had to do. In fact, we had a little saying about if you can't truck it, and then there was a swear word, so I won't repeat it. But I didn't do a lot of humping. All right. Yeah. But this is not the only part of his life, because after this time in the service, he goes on and tell me a little bit about what he did after he got out.
So, you know, he had an illustrious career, you know, specifically mostly during the time frame of Desert Storm. And so when he got out, he used like all these leadership skills that he learned in the military. I think you and I can attest to some of those that you gained during that tenure. And he used them to mentor and educate back on Pine Ridge. And, you know, like you said earlier, Lori, my uncle has spent 30 years in education, from the kindergarten to 12th grade level to the collegiate level. And he's always on the go mentoring students, and not only educational sides of things, but as a Lakota man and the wisdom he's learned along the way.
As you grow older, the only thing that stays constant will be your wisdom. I call it the wisdom. You know, the years that you gained, all that knowledge, everything, now you apply it. Let's give it up. Don't take it with you. Give it up.
Hmm. So, Lori, he also takes his students out to where he grew up along the White River, and he teaches them about the natural vegetation that grew along it, as well as fishing and stuff like watching for rattlesnakes, just the kind of stuff you do out in the country, you know. And I think it's really gets them back to their roots in that regards. And in the last 14 years, he's been testing the water there and along the Cheyenne River for any abnormalities too, as well.
I can't test the water coming in Nebraska, but I can test the water river coming in from Nebraska into South Dakota. So, and that's the, it's called the Upper White River Basin. So what I do is that the data that I collect, I send it to PIER and I send some to the United Nations because they monitor the water systems, the river systems around the world. And the White River is the last free-running river in South Dakota. All the other rivers are all dammed up.
Now, I understand some families still utilize these rivers for drinking water and other purposes.
Yeah, I think the work that he does when he tests the waters, Lori, is very important for that same reason because, you know, living out in the country, equipment fails, wells run dry. I think we can all relate to that due to, like, the ruralness of our state. You know, it's kind of a universal aspect of what comes when you think of water as being sacred. And anyways, Lori, I wish we had more time to talk about the interesting things that my uncle has done and, you know, has yet to do, in my opinion. You know, he's always on the go. There's a lot more stuff that I wish I could have told you about him. But yeah, it was fun talking to him. And what I really liked the most is just hearing his stories about some of my relatives that are, you know, that are here and some that are no longer here and some that are even before my time. So anyways, Lori, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, a little bit about Bill Ten Fingers. You've been listening to SDPB's Richard Tubbles. Richard, thanks so much. We'll see you next time. Ahead on the program, we are going to look at the economy and the Consumer Price Index and help you understand what is happening with inflation. Joe Santos is with us. You're on Listener Supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Over the past several years, a vibrant new jazz scene has cohered in London. At the center of it is saxophonist Shabaka Hutchings. He's pushing the limits of jazz with several different bands, including Sons of Kemet, his longest-running project. Hutchings has just released his third Sons of Kemet album. It's titled Black to the Future, and we'll sample it along with other new releases on the next Jazz Nightly New Music Monday. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by Avera Health Plans. This is a second chance for individual and family health insurance coverage with expansion of tax credit qualifications, 24/7 virtual care, health coaches, and more. Extended enrollment now at AveraHealthPlans.com.
South Dakota Home Garden offers more opportunities for you to learn during South Dakota's short but sweet growing season. SDPB makes it easier by sharing gardening advice across all our platforms. Join us on TV, radio, and online at sdpb.org/sdhomegarden to keep your gardening ideas fresh this season.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate. Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at SDNCommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. From the price of gas to the price of indulgent snack foods, all eyes are on inflation as we navigate this pandemic economy together. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released the Consumer Price Index for April, which caused the markets to flutter. Joe Santos is professor of economics and Dykehouse Scholar of Money Banking and Financial Regulation at South Dakota State University, and he joins us from the Janine Basinger Studio at SDSU. Joe, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
All right, two things. How are you feeling about the Jacks right now? Tough weekend, but exciting.
I'm dealing with it. Very exciting, but a little difficult. Yeah, I feel for them.
Also, another side note to listeners, Marketplace Morning Report did a great story on the price of Twinkies and indulgent snack foods today. So go back and listen to that because it was really fun. But we are going to talk about the Consumer Price Index and help us ground this conversation by telling us what exactly that is a measure of.
Yeah, so this is something that the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates. And what they're trying to do with the Consumer Price Index is get a handle on what we think of generally as the average price level. So Ironically, rather than thinking about prices when you hear consumer price index, think about money and its purchasing power. And what they're really trying to get a handle on is what the purchasing power of money is doing. How much buying power does it have? How much stuff can a dollar buy today versus how much stuff a dollar could have purchased, say, a year ago this time? And so this consumer price index is really it's an inherently empirical thing. It's a measure of the prices of all sorts of goods and services, Twinkies included, that a typical household will purchase over the course of a year. And so they track this basket. As I like to tell my students, it's sort of like going through a supermarket with the same list of items to purchase and just buying them over and over and over again, month after month after month. And since you're buying the same stuff every month, if the cash register total increases, that means on average, the prices of the things you're buying must be going up because, again, the grocery list is fixed. So that's the consumer price index. It's a measure of the price level. And what we often do is say CPI and then immediately utter the word inflation, because the really interesting bit is not so much what this abstract average price of all stuff is, but rather what it did over time. And that was the news just last week when the BLS reported that year over year, April 2021 versus April 2020, the inflation rate measured very broadly by the CPI rose by 4.2%. And you can take a look at the blog and see the picture. 4.2% sort of sticks out from what we've been observing for months and months prior to that.
Yeah. And for listeners, this Monday Macro segment has an online component, and that is Joe Santos's blog. You can follow along at schooled.blog.com, and you're going to spell out that first dot, schooled, D-O-T, blog, .com. And so my first inclination is, well, 2020 was such an off year. Prices dropped. Is this because of 2020 and the pandemic economy and prices being low?
Yeah, that's a really perceptive first inclination. That's what we call a base month effect. And yeah, so if we're calculating year over year, we're taking this, say, April CPI, subtracting last April CPI, and here's the kicker, dividing by last April CPI. And that number is very low because that's in the heat of the pandemic. So there is a base effect associated with this 4.2%. And sure enough, there's this sort of abstract notion economists have conjured, which is to say, what if the pandemic hadn't happened? What would last April look like? And then, calculate the inflation rate accordingly. So if you factor out the base effect, estimates are it's something around 1% of the 4.2%. And so you'd still have a 3-point-something% inflation rate, even if you factor in that base effect. So that's a really good point. Yes, it is in part as high as it is because April of 2020 was as low. The CPI was as low as it was. But even after that, the number surprised folks. And as you mentioned in the intro, folks in financial markets in particular were not terribly comforted by 4.2%.
Right. Now, this is not the price of indulgent snack foods is not the same as the price of gas, for example. What are some of those areas that we're seeing have really skyrocketed, if I can use that word?
Yeah. So if you break down, as you take a look at, say, that 4.2% and say, okay, what were the major contributors to 4.2%? Gasoline was the biggest. That jump from, again, that very low base in April, and the base effects are inside all these numbers I'm blurting out. Gasoline went up 50%. Now, not all of our budget is directed to gasoline, so it contributed about 1.2 percentage points of the 4.7.
Right.
Shelter, rent, as we've all know. It's funny if you look at the list, well, funny in a horrifying sort of way, it's all the stuff we've experienced during the pandemic. Used cars and trucks went up 21%. Mm-hmm. Again, not all of our budget goes to used car and trucks, so that only contributed about 0.5% to the 4.2. If you've tried to order a sofa in the last 12 months, you know the furniture has also gone up in price, and that leads the list of contributors as well. So a lot of this stuff, I think we all would associate with aspects of lockdown for sure.
Yeah. All right. Which leads to this idea that, well, if I don't order new furniture and I don't get a new car and I kind of keep my driving and hold on tight, this is all going to pass and inflation isn't going to be an issue. Is this just a blip? please?
Yeah, so this is the Fed's favorite term here, because, you know, blip would be too cool and sensible, so they go with transitory. Yeah, so the Fed has been arguing it's transitory. It's short-lived. Once these base effects work themselves out and, you know, supply chains and so on come back full force, labor markets heal and so on, that in a few months we're going to see the inflation rate return to something more reasonable, something in the neighborhood of 2%, perhaps north of it, but in the neighborhood of 2%. That's the Fed's position. The Fed doesn't know that that's going to happen, and no one else knows for sure that that's going to happen. And one sort of side in this argument, what I call the inflation hawks, with Paul Krugman has been calling the inflationistas, are looking at this and saying, no, this isn't transitory. This is the effect of an enormous increase in the supply of money, which we have also observed during the pandemic. And if you have more money, its purchasing power goes down. And so perhaps this isn't transitory at all. And this is the debate we're having right now. Is it a blip or is it the new normal?
The extraordinary increase in the supply of money, people are going to say, because of stimulus checks?
Stimulus activity in general, fundamentally central bank stimulus. They're the ones with the smoking gun. They have the money supply in control, and so they can increase the money supply, and they have done so essentially to alleviate pressures in financial markets. But yeah, we have again, if you look at some of these pictures, you can see where the pandemic is without looking at the horizontal axis where the date is. It's where the spikes are, and so you have this roughly 24% increase year over year in the stock of money recently. And just to give listeners a sense, 24 is big. A more normal number would be 7. So it's an enormous increase in the stock of money year over year. And again, the sort of inflation hawks view this as essentially something that's going to transmit its way through to price pressures. And again, they cite the 4.7% as data point number one in their sort of bucket of evidence.
All right. So with this sort of stored up wealth, because maybe you couldn't get, you know, some of the goods and services that you wanted to get, either you couldn't get your hair cut because you didn't want to go to the salon, or you couldn't buy that couch because you weren't happy with the selections, and you had the latitude and the luxury and the privilege of just waiting, it seems like that as people come back, it's all going to come rushing back into the economy. And I still want it to go back to some kind of normal as GDP. So help me figure out then, you know, what does this sort of expectation of inflation and this idea and this nervousness, how does that intersect with what seems like a logical, like, hold on, it can't all come back at once, but it is definitely coming back and things are going to return to a semblance of normal.
Yeah, so this gets to this idea of money supply, forgive me, and money demand, right? An economist, you knew that was coming. But you've got all this, you've got this large supply of money. But at the same time, what we're observing right now is this rather quirky circumstance that is not unprecedented, where, you know, no matter how much money is supplied to the economy, demand seems to sort of accommodate it. And so we willingly hold large balances of money relative to our income, relative to our spending, and so on. And so the very simple intuition here is, if we're willing to hold on to it and we're not surrendering it and chasing after each other saying, please take my dollar, then the purchasing power of the dollar need not fall. So there is, you know, a theory, it's a sort of old school Keynesian argument that one could make that says, just because the supply of money has gone up, it doesn't mean that this has to translate into inflation. And to your question, though everything is roaring back, it's also the case that the supply side of the economy is also roaring back, and logistics and supply chains and so on are healing. And in that process, we may have more stuff at precisely the amount of time at the moment when we want more stuff. And so all needn't be wrong with the world, but there is this issue of expectations. And this is the really, really tricky part. If we expect inflation, no matter what you and I say during this program, if listeners leave expecting inflation, they are likely to take matters into their own hands and protect themselves from the inflation. So if they set prices, they may raise them. If they have money in their possession, they may seek to surrender it because money is going to lose value. And so they'll take all of these these sort of actions in order to protect themselves from what they see as an impending inflation. And guess what? The outcome will be an impending inflation. It'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, there's the real kick in the teeth there is it really doesn't matter what the Fed does at the end of the day. What matters is how we perceive the Fed. And if the Fed lacks sufficient credibility to, we like to say the metaphor is anchor our expectations, you may get inflation no matter what the Fed does with the actual money supply.
Is all of this a conversation for people with money? You know, when it comes to people who lost their jobs during the pandemic or are suffering economically, is this conversation not for them? Or does it impact them because the prices go up in spite of, you know, sometimes I'm just cognizant of this idea that we talk about, you know, people having money and having stored up wealth. Well, there's a whole lot of people who don't have that.
That's right. And it is true that any moment in time when the price level rises, there are winners and losers. There's no question about this. The sort of canonical example is the borrower and the lender. So unanticipated rise in prices advantages the borrower who now pays back in cheaper dollars, and it disadvantages the lender who now receives so-called cheaper, you know, weaker dollars. So there are definitely winners and losers, and there are distributional aspects of inflation, to be sure. And at any moment in time, someone could be, I hate to call it the winning side of it. The winning side would mean you have no stock of wealth that will lose purchasing power. But nevertheless, at that moment, you have less to lose than someone with wealth would have to lose. But overall, you know, from 30,000 feet, inflation represents an instability in the price system. And, you know, not to get sort of too preachy about this, but if what we have is a free enterprise market-based economy, then what we rely entirely on is the price system. And inflation represents a deterioration and instability of that price system. So it's really difficult to allocate goods and services to their most efficient uses and yada, 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 if you don't have a price system that signals value efficiently. And inflation is the sure way to distort that price system. So in the end, no one benefits from high and volatile inflation because of the instabilities and distortions it creates. But at the moment an inflation rate hits and no one saw it coming, sure, folks who are paying labor benefit. Folks who receive a fixed wage lose, for example. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm.
So fascinating. If you love geeking out about this stuff like we do, you can go online, schooled.blog.com. We'll put a link up on our website as well at sdpb.org and our episode page for today. And you can link to all the extra equations and fun stuff that Joe Santos has put on that blog. Joe is a professor of economics and Dykehouse Scholar of Money, Banking, and Financial Regulation, South Dakota State University. He's one of our favorite recurring guests for Monday Macro, and he joined us from the Janine Basinger Studio at SDSU. Joe, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much, Lori.
On this day in 1916, a hearing was held in Anoka, South Dakota, challenging the Minneapolis and St. Louis Railroad's decision to discontinue passenger service on the Lebeau branch of their line. Starting in 1884, the Minneapolis and St. Louis Railroad built a major spur west from the Twin Cities through Watertown, west of the Missouri River. Anoka is located in northwest Fault County near the west end of that line. And Lebeau was a major railhead for the cattle industry. Passenger service spiked when homesteaders traveled west in the 1890s and early 1900s. But by 1916, passenger numbers had dropped, and the railroad proposed ending passenger service on the western end of that branch. After the hearing, the railroad reversed their decision, reestablished that passenger service. Well, another spike in passenger service demand came a short time later when soldiers needed transportation during World War I. But with other rail competition and the development of the road system and car ownership, passenger rail service dwindled. Although there were brief increases, over the next 40 years or so, passenger services were cut station by station from west to east. And finally, in May 1960, the final passenger train from Watertown to Minneapolis rumbled to a halt. That was on July 20th, 1960. Well, in 1887, the railroad charged its patrons the usual 4 cents per mile in South Dakota. That made one-way train passage from Watertown to the Minneapolis area $6.82. The fare from Watertown with connections to Chicago was $7.25. On this day, that's 105 years ago, that hearing was held in Anoka, and it resulted in a temporary reprieve for passenger rail service on the Minneapolis-St. Louis rail line. More South Dakota history is ahead. On this week's Images of the Past, Brian Gevick is with us with the sounds of electric guitars from the National Music Museum. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. The desire for freedom is one of the most powerful forces in the world. But what is it? Author Sebastian Younger turned a long, solitary, illegal walk along active rail lines into an attempt to answer that question.
What people have to understand is that freedom means freedom from oppression, not freedom from obligation.
Next time, here and now. Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
President Biden wants to improve cybersecurity. That workforce, though, it's already real shorthanded.
On average, a cyber worker is getting 4 phone calls a week for opportunities.
I'm Kai Rizdal, help wanted in national security. We will have that story for you. The rest of the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
When Jen and Ty Moe was relocated to Webster, South Dakota 15 years ago, they cut the cord, and Jen says the programming is very meaningful to their family.
We're not paying anything for the antenna, but it's worth enough to me that I want to make a monthly donation to make sure that we've got it in our home and that we're supporting it. We're very proud to partner with South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Become a sustaining member of SDPB at sdpb.org/donate.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, the guitar is the descendant of stringed instruments dating back hundreds of years. The electric guitar was born from a desire to make the instrument stand out in a band or ensemble. But musicians soon discovered that the electric guitar's potential was far greater than just being louder. In today's Images of the Past, we continue the series called Old Guitars and the Local Musicians Who Love Them. And we'll explore the sounds of 2 electric guitars in the collection of the National Music Museum in Vermilion. SDPB's Brian Gevick returns. He is producing the series, and he joins us now. Hey, Brian, welcome back.
Oh, thanks very much.
It is time to go electric. Tell me about some of these instruments.
Okay, well, we're going to look at 2 electric guitars, and both of them are from the 1950s. Mm-hmm. They're quite different in design, and I think, you know, ahead we're going to hear that they also sound quite a bit different. I spoke with Arian Sheets. She's the curator of stringed instruments at the National Music Museum in Vermilion. She brought 2 electric guitars from their collection to our studio. There's a 1952 Gibson Les Paul, and a very unusual-looking Gibson called an Explorer that was built in 1958 but updated in 1967. We'll start with the Les Paul.
And it wasn't really designed by Les Paul. It was more a product that was created by Gibson, and they had, you know, Les Paul sign on to market it. There were some aspects where he had feedback. So this is kind of a, you know, their first attempt at doing a solid body electric guitar. And again, it was Gibson. It was a high quality product, and it became a classic.
Mm. All right. Tell listeners who Les Paul is in case they don't know.
Well, Les Paul was a musician, and he was also an inventor and a real tinkerer. He lived in New Jersey, but he lived other places across the country as well. He was a performer, but he's probably best known as being the guy who really made some innovations with electric guitars that stuck. He was among the first people to build a solid body electric guitar. He built his own. And you know, if you can find one of those, you have found something very, very special.
I bet. All right, about this Explorer now. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that's a really different kind of animal. Well, we'll have Arian Sheets explain that for us.
they weren't very popular, but especially the Explorer was not very popular. And there are only a few dozen that left the factory in those original years, 1958-59. And so there were some bodies that kind of hung around the factory that just were never finished. It wasn't worth finishing them. Nobody really wanted them. But then gradually they would get finished off. A whole bunch of them left the factory in 63-64. So they were fitted with pickups, trim, etc. for that time period. The one that we have at the National Music Museum was probably the last one or one of the very last ones to leave, and that was in 1967.
And do we know anything about the provenance of this particular guitar, Brian?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This guitar was purchased by a musician who lived in Memphis. This musician happened to be a very good friend of John Entwistle, who was the bassist with The Who. John Entwistle bought the guitar from this guy in Memphis, and, you know, for a bassist to buy a guitar like that might not seem that strange if you realize that Entwistle had the Explorer in a bass. He had a bass Explorer. Well, he ended up selling it back to the guy in Memphis who ended up donating it to the museum. So, you know, its background is pretty well known.
All right, let's hear something.
Okay, we asked a professional guitarist to play some short bits of music on each. Mike Hilson, he is an instructor of guitar at the Music Museum at the U.S. University of South Dakota, and he plays all kinds of music. We'll start with the 1952 Gibson Les Paul.
That sounds nice.
Okay.
All right.
Then,
keep going.
You know, I threw a curveball at you. Did you hear where the music kind of went? Did you hear where the music kind of faded in the middle of it?
Yeah.
That moved over to the Explorer, and I'm wondering if you could tell any difference. Well, this time we're going to be a little more transparent here on this one.
Okay.
We're going to hear both guitars, and just, you know, as a reminder, there's going to be a little bridge of silence or a fade.
Got
in the
it.
And, you know, musicians could play jazz on either guitar, but the Explorer really isn't anybody's choice for that genre. So let's see what they sound like with some harder edged rock.
There is a little bit of that difference there,
yeah.
Brian Gevick. We're going to wrap for today and send people to sdpb.org/images-of-the-past, and you can see pictures and hear more from these musicians. We've got some great South Dakota musicians coming up for this series. Brian, I can't wait to hear some more.
Yep, it's going to be fun.
Thanks so much for being here. Again, you can go sdpb.org/images-of-the-past for more about old guitars and the local musicians who love them, and join us on Mondays for Images of the Past. Well, the South Dakota State University football team made it to the Division I championship in Frisco, Texas this weekend, but a high-energy game ended in a devastating loss. I spoke with SDPB's sports reporter Nate Weck this morning about that game. Nate, thanks for being with us this morning. What a weekend for the Jacks, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of fun to see all the, you know, on Twitter and Facebook, all the people that we're making the trip down to Frisco to be a part of that atmosphere known as the national championship game. And, you know, it just seemed like everybody for the most part was having a good time. And I think, you know, even though maybe the results didn't go the way that a lot of South Dakota State University fans went, I think a lot would agree that if they made it again tomorrow, I think they'd probably go back.
Yeah. All right. Set the scene, because we have weather issues at this game that become part of the game itself.
Right. So pretty much all morning, I turned on the, I was looking at the forecast on Saturday to see what the weather was going to be like. And I turned on the pregame show with Tyler Merriam right at noon. And they're like, it's pouring. It's very heavy rain. There's strong winds that are just going to continue to pick up. It's going to make for some interesting field conditions. And before we even got to halftime, we had extremely heavy downpour. We had very strong wind gusts at times, and we even had a lightning delay that extended just over an hour as well. So that, and all of that happened, I believe it was like 8-something left in the second quarter by the time they finally resumed play. So, you know, as a national championship game, you know, a lot of them are indoors. You know, the FCS national championship is always in Frisco. It's always outdoors, but it's one of those things that when it is outdoors, especially in the month of May, rather mm-hmm. than when it typically would be in, say, you know, in that Christmas, New Year's bubble where it typically is with a fall season, you kind of get all that weather. And, you know, Mother Nature definitely made herself known during that game.
Yeah, you might play in some snow, but you're not necessarily ready for the lightning delay. Is that
exactly?
But now SDSU hired that, you know, mental toughness coach, so they were prepared mentally to sort of deal with that kind of delay. They might not have been fully prepared to deal with the injury of their starting quarterback, though. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it was really early in the game. There was a play where, you know, Mark Gronowski, freshman, he's very good. One of the reasons why he is so good and dangerous and why he's been so successful this year is because of what he can do with his legs. And there was a play very early on where there was a pileup. It looked like he kind of got tackled awkwardly, maybe slipped a little bit on that wet surface and came out for the next snap. And you could tell as soon as he threw it and kind of landed that something just wasn't quite right with that, with one of his legs. And you could see him trying to jog it off on the sideline, but definitely showing a very distinct limp. And they decided he's not going to be able to return for the game. So at that point, Keaton Heidi came into the game as relief and had to finish out the game. So really, you know, you lose your starting quarterback, you know, on your first offensive possession, really. And then you have to continue the rest of the game with a player that, you know, hasn't really had to do much of anything as far as playing throughout the regular season and up to this point. Coach Stiegelmeyer did talk a little bit about Mark Gronowski in his post-game remarks, because I think a lot of people are wondering, you know, what is the status moving forward? Yeah. And here's what Coach Stiegelmeyer had to say.
Our starting quarterback, Mark Gronowski, has a pretty serious injury. We'll evaluate it more, but it's a serious injury. Disappointed for him. But I tell you what, our players learned a lot from him. To have that happen in the championship game, and him to keep his head up and signal during the game and help his team try to win a game, a tremendous foundation of that young man. Keaton Heidi came in and played. I thought he played okay. You know, his play is somewhat dependent on the guys in front of him, and I thought at times he did well, and at times he had some pressure and had to get plays off. So I would say he did what we asked him to do and gave us a chance to win the game.
All right, Nate, I think we ought to come off of that, though, since that was the beginning of the game, and talk about the drama of the end of the game, because a lot of Jackrabbit fans thought that it was maybe in the bag.
Yeah, it was. So, you know, going into the fourth quarter, it's 17-7. Early in the fourth quarter, I believe there was just over 13 minutes left. Isaiah Davis gets a 28-yard touchdown run. And it's like, all right, now we're back to a one-possession game. There's a little bit of life here. And then with just under 6 minutes to play, SDSU got pinned deep. I think they were on their own 15-yard line. And Isaiah Davis once again breaks free for an 85-yard touchdown to give South Dakota State that lead. And it was at that point where it's like, man, if the defense can just continue doing what they've been doing up until this point, you know, SDSU's got a chance to actually pull this thing off, you know. And up until that point, you know, outside of the run game, there was really nothing happening offensively for the Jacks. And then it came down that final 16 seconds, and you know, Eric Schmidt throws that pass right over the middle, and it's a touchdown with 16 seconds to go. So, I mean, it was just one of those things. I think if you're a football fan, it's a great game. I think entertaining. You probably got everything you wanted. You want national championship games to go down to the wire. You want them to be exciting. Nobody likes to see a blowout. But I think a lot of the local fans in this area would have preferred if the result would have been different. But you know what? Sometimes that's just the way it goes. Coach Stiegelmeier did talk a little bit, too, about just the spring season in general, because it is so unique. Obviously, the fall season getting postponed because of COVID, getting the opportunity to play in the spring. So here's Coach Stiegelmeier's remarks about, you know, getting the opportunity to play this spring, and then also, you know, just coming up slightly short here in the national championship game.
Well, we didn't have to play in the spring. We got to play in the spring. I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but we embraced it. It wasn't something that we questioned at all. How should our fans remember this? They should remember a bunch of guys that bonded together and gave everything they had. They gave up time with their family in December, 3 weeks. Gave up time in January, a week, to be with their teammates, to work hard for this moment, for those few plays they got today. And I hope you know, football is a fickle game, so yeah, we can play better. But I hope the Jackrabbit fans are proud of our program. And if anybody fell short today, it was their head football coach.
So, Nate, what does that fall season look like, especially with how many of these athletes are getting back in the gym and will be playing in the fall?
Yeah, well, Coach Stink said he's got 12 seniors right now that are pretty hungry. And right now, obviously, they're disappointed. But they're, you know, there's not really a ton of time to think about it, because June 7th is already the organized lifting activities. And your first game is that September 4th. You know, they got to go to Colorado State and start their fall season, you know. So we're looking at this going, you know, in 2 months here, they're going to really be diving in and preparing and trying to get as ready as they possibly can for this fall season, which is super unique in the sport of football. Yeah. But, you know, this is, you know, it's one of those things. And I think a lot of people will be asking themselves, you know, with Mark Gronowski, with that injury, you know, if it is as serious as what some people are hoping that it's not.
Right.
You know, it just kind of depends. You know, if it is serious, you know, maybe his 2021 fall season is also in question.
I spoke with SDPB's Nate Weck about that game this morning. You can follow all of South Dakota Public Broadcasting sports coverage on Facebook and on Twitter. If you want to find Nate, go to Twitter @Nate_Weck SDPB. Weck is spelled W-E-K. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. On the next In the Moment, number one best-selling author and podcaster extraordinaire John Green is with us. He is award-winning, and his new book is called The Anthropocene Reviewed. It's his first sort of memoir and nonfiction book. We had a delightful conversation. We're going to bring that to you tomorrow on the release of his new book. For Crystal Schoenbauer and Steve Zwemke and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.